Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Emily McCord, filling in for Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Juliette Frumholt speaks to Brad Senner, an organizer of the Miami Valley Music Festival that's coming up later in August. This week, lots of news coming out of the Supreme Court, and later on in the program, we'll speak about immigration on Politics Ohio. Then we'll join Bill Cohen as he reports on Ohio's reaction to President Obama's healthcare decision. First, though, the documentary Sparkle by local filmmakers Julia Reichert and Steve Bognar won the Audience Award for the Best Short Documentary at Silver Docs. I spoke to both of them earlier this week to tell me what the film is about.
Sparkle is Sherry Williams. She's a dancer. She's a modern dancer, contemporary dance, very, very vigorous dancer. She's with the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company. And as we find out to our surprise, when we first met her for this film, she was 49 years old.
I found that hard to believe. I got to see just a few minutes of this film, and that alone is shocking to me.
She looks like she's 23. And, you know, she leads the workouts at DCDC, and no one can keep up with her. I mean, she's twice the age of most of the other dancers, and no one can keep up with her.
By the end of the workout, she's laughing and still standing, and everybody else is like
collapsed,
literally curled up on the floor, just lying down, panting. And she's like, okay, guys, that was good. Let's go. You know, she's just.
And Sherry, I think Sherry, I'm not sure exactly how she got the name Sparkle, but her personality just shines. She radiates energy. And I don't know where that comes from, but it's amazing.
And that dynamism, and I think, really comes through in the film. And it really is amazing to watch her body. It's mm-hmm. a magnificent thing, the way that she dances. I mean, you know, it's not exactly the ballerina type, I suppose.
Well, Sherry actually has had dances choreographed for her body because her body is so unusual for a dancer. Sherry is 5 feet one. I mean, think about dancers. Long, lean, long neck, slender. Sherry is 5'1", as I said. She's African-American, which also does not fit your typical ballerina dancer. She's very athletic. Her muscles just ripple like a boxer almost, just beautiful. So she doesn't – when you look at her, you don't think graceful dancer.
Well, she is incredibly graceful, but in a different kind of way. Really, Sherry talks about this in the film. Her career is kind of unlikely.
Let's hear that now.
We would always travel around. Geraldine would have us go to different conferences and different workshops. You know, the people I would see there, nothing like me, you know. First of all, usually white, long, and then very small, almost bony, and not athletic looking at all, you know, that kind of thing. And I would get, because as I started to dance more, I really enjoyed it and thought I'd like to do this for a little bit. And I thought that I wouldn't be able to. You know, why should I keep trying this if this isn't what people want to see and that kind of thing? And Geraldine set me down and told me that you don't have to be cookie cutter. You know, you make your way.
When Sherry says Geraldine, she's referring to Geraldine Blunden, who founded DCDC in the 1960s. And, you know, if you're new to Dayton or if you've been out of the loop, you should know that everyone should know that DCDC is like an incredible treasure of Dayton, Ohio. This is a dance company that has performed all over the world. They've received huge New York Times reviews, glowing reviews. When they perform in New York, they play at the Joyce. They played at the Kennedy Center. They played at Lincoln Center, performed there. They go everywhere. They're incredibly respected in the dance world. They've worked with Alvin Ailey, Bill T. Jones, Merce Cunningham, all the biggest names in dance. They're an amazing treasure, and they come from and remain here in Dayton.
One of the main storylines of this documentary is that Sherry Williams gets injured, and it seems that this is a pretty devastating injury. I mean, what happened?
So last fall here in Dayton, Ohio, DCDC was performing on stage their fall concert, and for the first time in her career, Sherry had a major injury right on stage, mid-dance. She actually thought one of the other dancers had kicked her, but her hip kind of popped, and it was incredible pain, and she barely – now, she's a pro.
She stayed on stage.
you see her stay on stage. And we were very lucky in the film that a local filmmaker, Gregory Tucker, was filming the concert in high definition. And you see her injury right there on stage. It's just incredible to see and very painful. You can see her masking her pain. But she got through this part of the number, and she got off stage and just collapsed.
So after this injury, I mean, for the first few days, she just couldn't do anything. She was kind of in shock, and she, of course, went to doctors. It turned out, you know, she's 49 years old, going on 50, and she had to decide whether she could do or wanted to do the work that would be involved to come back up to performance speed. So she really had to decide, crossroads, you know, am I going to go out on an injury, or am I going to somehow make it back?
I mean, it's almost the way that an athlete has to view their career. It's an injury really can take you out.
And every dancer wants to end their career on their own terms. No dancer wants to be forced out of a career, you know, just because of an injury. And the thing we learned, at any moment, an injury can end a career or, you know, really impair a person. And, you know, I mean, filmmakers don't have that. You know, musicians don't have that. Dancers, they put their careers on the line every time they get on stage.
I'm speaking with Julia Reichert and Steve Bognar. They're the filmmakers. They've directed the film Sparkle, which just won the Best Audience Award at the Silver Docks Festival in Washington, D.C. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We were really, like, completely not expecting that.
Yeah, you say that. I'm curious. Why were you so surprised?
Well, this was the film's debut, you know, so the film had never been shown publicly anywhere. And we were just grateful to get into the festival. It's very competitive. They had 2,000 submissions, and they show just 100 films. But each one of those 100 films is excellent. And, you know, it's very hard to win the audience award. So we're just stunned. We're grateful. We think it really has a lot to do with Sherry and DCDC, that they just mm-hmm. flow. You know, their energy, their excitement just flows off the screen. It's just really – anyway, we're blown away.
Well, and the audience award, it's actually the audience that votes on it, which is unusual for other awards.
Yeah, every time you leave the theater, you vote. Every movie you see, you get a ballot and you rank it. And the film with the overall highest ranking.
It's 1 to 5 from, you know, didn't like it to liked it the best. So we must have gotten a ton of fives. Steve, as we were leaving the festival, you happened to pass by and there were people like counting these mounds of in total silence. You know, it's like, I don't know, it's like the Supreme Court or something. We didn't even think about it. We drove into the night, you know, with our daughter and grandbaby in the back seat. And at around 11:30, just before midnight, the phone rang. And I'm thinking, this is weird. Why is our friend calling us just before midnight? And it didn't even enter my mind that he would be calling about winning an award. I mean, winning the audience award. But that's what it was.
We had the great fortune of screening with another movie about dance called Trash Dance, which is made by former Daytonian Andy Garrison.
And Antioch graduate.
He's an Antiochian, and he's an awesome filmmaker. And his feature documentary tells the story of the Austin, Texas Sanitation Department and their collaboration with a choreographer as they create a dance piece for garbage trucks. It sounds crazy as I describe it, but it's an amazing film. It's already won big prizes at other festivals, and I think, you know, we were lucky to be programmed with it because I think it helped. But the films played off each other really well.
The audience had a really good time. I mean, that is true. We got a long, sustained applause. When Sparkle walked in front of the audience, the whole audience stood up and applauded. They even applauded at the end of the Q&A. They also, of course, stood up for Trash Dance. But it was great because Andy went to college with me here at Antioch. So we're like old, old, old friends from when we were in our early 20s. So it was really cool that we were programmed together. And I believe, am I not mistaken, Mr. Film Dayton, that Trash Dance is going to show at the Film Dayton Festival?
Film Dayton's annual festival is coming up in August 24, 25, 26. And we are so thrilled we're going to be able to have the Dayton premiere, the Ohio premiere of Trash Dance.
Was this the first time you've ever had a film premiere to a live audience that you've been actually able to witness?
No. We're very lucky that we've been able to be at a lot of festivals with our films and be there when they have their world premiere.
Was this particular reaction unique?
I will say, when Sherry walked in front of the audience and everyone leapt to their feet, that was really, really special. We all love Dayton, Ohio. You know, we love Dayton, Ohio, but in a way we're kind of removed from New York or L.A. And I know Sherry has been asked to move to New York many times, and she chose to stay in Dayton, like many of us. For her to get that level of validation outside of Dayton is really meaningful.
What's next for Sparkle? Are we going to see it at a theater near us?
We actually are working with DCDC, the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company, with their leadership to plan a really, really special event sometime this fall, which would be film and dance. So it would be kind of a really kind of posh night. So we're not just going to show it as a film. We're going to make it into an event.
I'm sure you'll be keeping us posted on that.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with Julia Reichert and Steve Bognar. They've directed the film Sparkle. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Emily.
Hey, thank you, Emily. This was cool.
The summer music festival season is already well underway, and preparations have begun for the Miami Valley Music Festival, and that's on August 10th and 11th in Troy. WYSO's Juliette Fromholt spoke with Brad Centers, one of the festival's organizers, earlier this week on Kaleidoscope. They began by talking about how the event got started.
Well, it started out, actually, our executive director, Nick Christian. He actually started a little festival kind of out in the Covington area, just small, you know, one-day thing. And then Brad Denton was also doing a festival called the Lost Creek Music Review. Well, they combined forces. And, I mean, they just kind of made it happen. I got involved, started doing a lot of the promoting, started, you know, blowing it up, getting out there, getting, you know, good with people. And we just kind of, you know, got more bands, got in, and we just, you know, kind of made it happen.
And the event has really grown over the past couple of years, from what I can tell. You've got a great lineup this year. Acoustic Hookah is signed on, the Spike Drivers, Signs of Life, the group that does the Essence of Pink Floyd, good friends of the show. You've got Soul, Grover, Jostle, Al Holbrook. How do you guys even begin to decide who you want when you're building a festival?
Well, it's not necessarily about who we want. It's kind of who wants to play. It's what we do. Our music festival is generally based on local music. There's so much music out here in the Miami Valley, and that's where our roots come from. And at first, we started out just Miami Valley. Then we added more like Boogie Matrix. We have Glowstick Willie coming out of Muncie. I mean, Shank Bones coming out of Columbus. I mean, it's really, we just try to show the talent that we have in our backyard and in our neck of the woods. So this year, I mean, it's a big year. We got 48 bands on the bill. We got 4 stages. And I mean, we're just, you know, going to have fun with it.
Now, what sets you guys apart from some of the other music festivals in the area is that your festival is for charity.
Yes, we are a 501c3 nonprofit charity organization.
Why did you guys decide to go that route when you were originally formulating the event?
Well, I mean, we just kind of want to give back to the community. I mean, we want to show people that you can support local charity, but do it in your own way and in your own fashion and have fun with it. You know, we do river runs. We had a river run this year, which was very successful. We had Demolition Crew play that, along with Mark Cantwell and a bootleg blues band. Which we had like 60 people come out with the Miami County Park District, and we clean up the couple parks with the Park District, and I mean, it was great. I mean, we do clothing drives, food drives. I mean, we do whatever we can just to kind of get the word out. I mean, you come out, you get to be who you are, you get to do what you love to do, and I mean, you get to clean up, you know, make the earth beautiful, you get to help feed somebody, help clothe somebody, and I mean, it's all, then we reward you at the end of the night with, you know, amazing music. I mean, what could be better? I mean,
for somebody who maybe hasn't come out before, that's thinking about coming to the festival for the first time this year, describe for me the atmosphere, what it's like over that weekend.
Well, I technically haven't got to see it as a goer, but I mean, I'm running around like crazy.
You're probably pretty busy.
But, you know, I've heard from everybody who has attended that's, you know, been on the outside. They say it's very laid back. It's family atmosphere. This year we're going to add in a kiddie zone. I mean, we're going to make it, you know, as family oriented as possible. It's nothing too crazy, you know, nothing too lame. I mean, it's just right. It's bring your own beer. You know, we just ask no glass bottles. I mean, you know, keep your dog on a leash. I mean, we're very laid back.
And bringing in the kids zone, that's a cool idea that I haven't, at least in the festivals I've experienced, seen a lot of that happening yet. But it seems like as a certain generation of music fans are getting older, that would be kind of necessary to get them out to the shows, offer something for the whole family, not just the adults in the group.
Well, I mean, that's what we want to do. And I mean, we're going to have family camping. So, you know, if you're not, you know, out there for the wild time, you know, I mean, you can be family camping. I mean, we're just going to, you know, play it laid back.
It sounds like just all around, it's just, it's coming from a place of just like, come be a part of our family, really.
Yeah.
I like that.
We're very welcoming. We come with open arms.
That was Kaleidoscope host Juliet Frumholt speaking with Brad Centers about the Miami Valley Music Festival in August. One of the bands on the festival bill also stopped by the YSO studios this week to perform on Kaleidoscope. Here's Soul, live from the WYSO performance space.
Why take advantage of her? Kind of mama. Never put a door on her. Move in my mind.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. And we've had some big news this week from the Supreme Court. Of course, there was the healthcare decision Thursday. But I want to linger on some news earlier this week regarding their decision to strike down much of Arizona's immigration law. But they kept the part where police can check the immigration status of anyone they want to arrest. I'm speaking with Tony Ortiz. He's from Wright State University and is the Latin community liaison with the university. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
There's a legislator in Ohio who wants to revive a plan to let local police and sheriffs ask if they're legal. And I'm just curious, what do you think that the response is from the Hispanic community?
Adamantly against it, because there's a lot of legal Latinos in Ohio who would be subjected to what I would call harassment or racial profiling. You know, they keep talking about, and they talk about undocumented. A lot of times they refer, you know, they don't come out and say it, but they're referring to Latinos. But there are as many undocumented in other areas as well. Go through the system correctly, like we've done here in Dayton, Ohio. If there are issues with the immigrants are undocumented, face that. Don't subject all Latinos to that scrutiny.
No, it's interesting. It seems like Dayton is actually recruiting immigrants, wants to make the city an immigrant-friendly city. Is that something you're part of?
Yes. You know, and one of the things we've been doing, there's a meeting every 3 months with the representatives from the police department, Dayton City. If there are issues with the undocumented, those are brought up at this meeting, and we try to come up with solutions. So we confront the problem head on versus trying to make an umbrella law, which will have a huge negative effect not only on undocumented, but as well as the documented. You're going to scare people away and they're not going to report crimes. They're going to be more victims of crime than they are now.
Can you give me some examples of ways that ideas that you guys have as solutions to the immigration issue?
Well, if there's let's say there's a rash of crime in a particular neighborhood. And if the undocumented are subjected to that and are afraid to come forward, that will continue. So as things come up, we discuss them, what happened, what can be done, and it's done. Very rarely do you ever see any positive news about the Latinos and how much they've contributed in the area. You know, for instance, there are a lot of Latinos. There's more Latinos with higher advanced degrees in the Miami Valley than anywhere else in the state of Ohio. And probably in the top 10 in the whole country. We have a lot of Latino engineers that have been recruited from Puerto Rico and other locations to basically help with the defense of the country. Okay, there are a lot of Latinos that serve in the Air Force and the Armed Services. But rather than concentrating or basically talking about the positive these people have contributed, we always just get the pushback that we've been getting here or in anywhere else in the rest of the country, you know, like Arizona and Alabama. Why would any Latino ever want to live there or contribute to that? But unfortunately, there are Latinos. They're basically going to go where the jobs are. They're going to go where they feel welcome.
and hopefully Dayton will be that city. But again, we have to look at policies and how they negatively affect people, no matter what background they come from.
There's also a movement in Ohio to help college become more affordable for children of undocumented immigrants. It's Ohio's version of the DREAM Act, the federal DREAM Act. Senator Tavares is introducing this legislation, and she told Ohio Public Radio earlier in the week that this was not a political decision, but certainly immigration is a very hot topic right now. Is there potential that this legislation is capitalizing on that?
It could be, but the end goal, I think, is a good goal. I mean, you're going to basically take care of kids that that are victims and giving them an opportunity to go to school and make something of themselves. You know, we've been trying to get bipartisan support for the last year and a half. And I thought we were close, but still there are some folks that push away because they don't want to enter into a hot area that may jeopardize them getting reelected.
I want to look to the future, the next coming months. This, I'm sure, will be playing out politically as we head towards the presidential election. What do you expect to see?
Well, unfortunately, this issue will be tossed around like a football and people's lives will be affected. You don't know whether it's going to be positive or negative. I'm hoping it's more positive. But at some point, the politicians need to put politics aside and basically deal. These are real people issues.
I've been speaking with Tony Ortiz from Wright State University. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the national health insurance law seems to have revved up the passions of Ohio activists on both sides of the issue. On Friday, within 4 miles of each other, both groups rallied in Columbus, and Ohio Public Radio's Bill Cohen was there.
At the state fairgrounds, hundreds of activists on Ohio's political right began a 2-day meeting that had been scheduled long before the court verdict. Advocates at various booths hawked their causes: the NRA, Christian schools, lower taxes, an abortion ban. But the court ruling the health care law constitutional was the big buzz. Tea Party leader from Avon Lake, Dave Zupan, was there.
Speaking from a military standpoint, when you lose a battle, the troops get inspired. They're like, you know what? That was a nasty loss, but we're not going to take that. We're going to regroup, and we're going to kick their ass in the next battle. The next battle in Ohio is November.
Zupan pushed the Senate campaign of conservative Republican Josh Mandel and said Romney could win Ohio on Mandel's coattails. The head of a coalition of more than 70 local Ohio Tea Party groups, Tom Zawatowski, agreed that's now the only solution for foes of the national health care law and its mandate that virtually everyone must have coverage.
The bottom line is win in November. Everything else takes care of itself. In other words, we don't need any Supreme Court, we don't need the media, we don't need parties, we don't need anything. What we need to do is win that White House and win the Senate in November, and then Governor Romney is on the record as saying, I will repeal this.
Ironically, though, a lot of Tea Party folks, libertarians and conservatives, have thought up till now Mitt Romney was too liberal.
Well, and see, this is the kind of the come to Jesus moment for our movement, right? Because, you know, we ought to be adults. There's only two people really running, though Gary Johnson's going to be here at the convention, and we like him from the Libertarian Party. And that'd be great if he had a chance to win. But the reality is, this is about freedom and liberty versus statism. Mitt Romney happens to be the freedom and liberty candidate. Whether he's, you know, conservative enough for us doesn't matter. He's on the record saying, I will repeal this bill, you know, as soon as I get sworn in. That's good enough for us.
If anybody at the We the People conference personified the conservatives' dilemma, it was Nita Thomas from Cincinnati.
I'm really not that enthused about Romney himself, but now with this coming down, all my enthusiasm is going in that direction, including for him.
While activists on the right rallied at the fairgrounds, about 50 activists on the left rallied downtown across from the State House. What they meant by build it now was Ohio should finally move ahead implementing a key part of the national law by setting up exchanges that will let Ohioans compare various health insurance policies. Right after the high court declared the law constitutional, top Ohio officials, Republicans, said they continue to believe an exchange wouldn't be good for Ohio. They hinted Ohio won't move on one, which means the feds will impose their own on Ohio. That rankled Kathleen Geminer, a veteran advocate of health care for all.
We call on Ohio's lawmakers, Governor Kasich and Insurance Commissioner Mary Taylor, to get to work.
These activists personified their argument by highlighting Jenny Lynn. She said she'd been hit with breast cancer and her husband with rheumatoid arthritis.
In 2006, we were paying around $560 for our health insurance, and by 2010, we were paying just under $2,000.
Lynn said only through a high-risk pool linked with the national law had her family survived medically and financially. A leader of the left-leaning group Progress Ohio, Brian Rothenberg, advised the crowd to email and call their state legislators and the governor with a simple message.
The war is over. It's time to come together and enact the law.
Bill Cohen at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
It's time for Road Trip, our weekly series where radio producers from across the state take you on audio tours around Ohio. The new Ohio Guide is downloadable, and you can take them yourself. This week, we're on tour number 6 in northern Ohio. Producer Greg Tai takes you to an island that played an important role in American history.
A lot of people are surprised to learn there was a Battle of Lake Erie, but it was one of the most important victories in U.S. naval history. It happened during the War of 1812. The British Navy controlled the Great Lakes and could rapidly move troops and supplies. So the Americans built a fleet of ships at Erie, Pennsylvania, to challenge the British on Lake Erie. Walter Ripka is senior captain of the modern-day replica of the Brig Niagara.
The battle was fought about 10 miles west of Put-in Bay, Ohio. The Americans had 9 vessels under the command of Oliver Hazard Perry. The British had 6 vessels under command of Robert Harriet Barclay.
Dr. David Curtis Gaggs is author of biographies of both William Henry Harrison and Oliver Hazard Perry.
The British cannot resupply either their Indian allies or themselves in the Detroit River once Perry is on the lake. And so it is they who come out to fight. Perry is waiting at Put-in Bay, and on the morning of the 10th of September, 1813, begins to work his way towards the British squadron.
Perry needed to get in close range to the British fleet. The British, with their long guns, could shoot farther. So as Perry was approaching the British line, they started to fire on Perry and his flagship, the Lawrence.
Sue Judas is the chief of interpretation at Perry's Victory and International Peace Memorial. She says the Lawrence was named in honor of Captain James Lawrence, who was killed in a naval battle earlier in the War of 1812. It was Lawrence who told his men, "Don't give up the ship," a motto that Oliver Hazard Perry adopted for his battle flag. The British fleet battered the Lawrence to pieces because the other American brig, the Niagara, did not join the battle. Yet somehow Perry survived.
He pulled down his battle flag, which had the words, "Don't give up the ship," jumped into the little cutter, and sailed across to the Niagara.
Perry's transfer is one of the best-known episodes in U.S. naval history. His motto flag was, "Don't give up the ship." In the eventuality, the only way to win the battle was to give up the ship and go to the next one. The real motto was, "Don't give up."
Perry took command of the undamaged Niagara and captured the entire British fleet. He later wrote to General Harrison, "We have met the enemy, and they are ours. 2 ships, 2 brigs, 1 schooner, and 1 sloop." 100 years after the battle, Perry's Victory and International Peace Memorial was built at Put-in Bay, a 352-foot granite column that towers over Lake Erie. Susie Cooper of the Lake Erie Islands Historical Society.
Perry's Victory and International Peace Memorial was built not only to designate this area as the site of the Battle of Lake Erie during the War of 1812, but also it is a peace memorial to celebrate the peace between the United States and Canada. It's also a gravesite because the officers that died in the War of 1812, Battle of Lake Erie, were moved from our park to that location in 1913.
Put-in Bay is accessible from the Ohio mainland by ferry boat from Catawba, Sandusky, and Port Clinton. From the shores of Lake Erie, I'm Greg Tai.
That's it for WISO Weekend. If you've missed any of today's program, you can find it online at WYSO.org. Thanks for listening to 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, broadcasting in HD and online at WYSO.org. WISO is a service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. It's 11 o'clock.
Later today on This American Life, Jimmy Finkel wrote real estate stories that were published in newspapers in California and Florida, but nobody knew who he was.
So you don't know who Jimmy Finkel is?
I have no idea.
Yet you have edited a story with the byline of Jimmy Finkel. So who wrote it?
Probably. He was somebody thousands of miles away, hired to do the job from a desk in the Philippines. Switcheroos later today.
This afternoon at 4 on WISO.